Hello and good morning. Waiting for a few people maybe to drop in, but we can get started. So this is the morning of March 22nd, 2022. This is an open public Q&A, open to anyone who is here, anyone who can hear us. So there are a few questions that we're going to start with. I believe that I can access them at the same time. So fortunately, I don't have to use two screens as I've had to in the past. Let me know in the Q&A chat room, which is below the question. Just let me know that you can hear me now so that I don't have a false start. So there's a Q&A chat room that I set up below the announcement where the questions are. Okay, great. Thank you. Perfect. Thanks. Okay, great. Now then, so I'm just going to look at these in order, and I will try to, you know, answer actually very briefly. Sometimes I can get very detailed at the expense of more questions being answered. So we'll try not to do that. So the first one is about U.S. sanctions on China for harassing ethnic minorities. Question is, what will happen after this? I don't know that anything will happen after this. Blinken was under pressure to do something. That is the Secretary of State. He's from a wealthy family, never worked a day in his life, just FYI. Aged really badly in the past 5 or 8 years. Very strange. Makes you wonder sometimes, because these people don't have any stress in life. So you wonder, you know, why, where all this antioxidant activity is coming from, right? Anyway, so China, obviously this has nothing to do with Uyghurs. Uyghurs are a minority, one of the many different nationalities that make up China, which is a multinational civilizational space. China is, as a country, as a nation state, is one of the few, maybe only in the world, really, that makes up a complete civilizational space. When you look at other parts, you don't have that as much, really anywhere near. Russia might be close in some way, but the other Slavic nations have a lot of antipathy. Whereas in China, you have a lot of interrelated groups. And Uyghurs are very much related to other Chinese ethnicities, but their religion is Muslim. And so just briefly, just so people know background, for some reason, there's a lot of concern in media, both conservative and liberal, about the Uyghurs. This is not like a thing where Republicans care about in America, like where Republicans care about Uyghurs and Democrats don't. Know. Like, you know, all the mainstream left and right stuff in the U.S. is really concerned about Uyghurs. And I am too. China is a state. They have a police force. They have, you know, they have a strong capacity for internal repression. But things are never black and white, are they? On the other hand, you have factually a whole segment of the Uyghur population has been radicalized by elements probably at one point beginning with the Gulf monarchies and spreading Wahhabism, which is not the craziest thing per se, but then it opens the door for more extreme interpretations like, you know, Salafism. And so China had several policies. One, they let the most radicalized elements leave China to go fight in Syria on the side of ISIS, knowing that they would be confronting a meat grinder. I mean, they probably chipped them or had, you know, agents in there, and their locations were, they didn't even make it. A lot of them didn't even make it into conflict. They just got vaporized somewhere in the desert of Iraq or Syria. A little bit like what happened with the Nazi battalion over near Lviv in Ukraine, of the International Volunteer Brigade. Like, it was determined where they were by, I think maybe some are saying British cell phone signals, but same thing. So, I mean, China could have stopped radicalized Uyghurs from leaving China to go fight in Syria, but then they would have had them there. And they do have re-education camps. So that's the nature of those sanctions. But the sanctions are just on Chinese officials whose job is not really to come to the U.S. So it's token. I don't know anything happens after that. Next question is, what is Israel's role in the conflict? Is the Belt and Road Initiative just a way to make Jerusalem the tech trade banking nexus of the Eurasia? I know Larry Frank is pushing investing in China. Wow, those are a lot of different things, kind of all wound together. I don't know that in the interest of time, it can be unwound. There are, you know, always questions have assumptions, and sometimes like the assumptions built into the question are like closer to my operating framework, and others are, you know, too far apart to bridge. I would just say that Israel's being very close in many ways, aligning with U.S. policy, even more so during the Obama, you know, in all of the sort of mainstream Republican Democrat period, and again now in some ways, there's been some untangling or disentangling from the U.S. and Israel, actually, and AIPAC still has influence, and that's a lobbying group that many have argued should be considered a foreign organization, should be registered as foreign agents. But they exist in the U.S. as a U.S.-based political action committee, but they put a lot of pressure on American politicians to do what's in the interest of Israel's foreign policy. Any country would get away with that if they could. It's not particular to Israel. They just have a particular past to do it. And yet, nevertheless, you can see that there hasn't been tremendous support from the American administration for Ukraine, but there was a lot of support. You know, you had, it's really on the Ukrainian side where a lot of the oligarchs have, you know, double, triple, quadruple citizenship in numerous countries, including Israel. So famously people, of course, know Kolomoisky, but there's a whole slew of them that have multiple citizenships. And that includes some that have dual or triple citizenship, including Israel. And a lot of them have Canadian citizenship too. There's a long-standing Ukraine-Canada nexus. So, but we saw Zelensky get shot down by Israel in a real serious way. He just a few days ago spoke to the Knesset and apparently offended the whole country. They have a very strict custom that you can't compare anything to the Holocaust. In their view, the Holocaust was a unique event, and comparing things to it could lead towards the minimization of it. And whatever one's feelings about that are, one can see how there's a fair point there, of course, because in political rhetoric, it's easy to want to call everything a Holocaust. And that kind of trivializes the Holocaust, doesn't it? So from their point of view, you can see that they weren't pretending that this, they didn't invent a new custom to get mad at Zelensky. And what they really told him was, we're not supporting you. And that has been a very, there has been a very big change in Israel, because the ability of the U.S. to act on Israel's behalf in the region, as seen by the Syrian conflict, has greatly diminished. And so Israel has been looking to be balanced, and Russia has an interest with Iran and a good relationship with Iran, and also a good relationship with Israel. So this gets back to the traditions of diplomacy and foreign policy, which is that it's good when countries can have as many different friends in the world as possible. Alliances can actually be very, can become liabilities, as we've talked about here, which is not to say that alliances are bad. It's just, you know, these are all neutral things that are very case specific, if they work or not. But the default stance of a given country, in the absence of a specific strategic calculated need for a particular alliance, is to have as many friends as possible. It doesn't look like Israel has a particular ability to project or have a great influence over things. It looked more like Zelensky's appeal to Israel was to activate not the Knesset to make some kind of determination, although that was his, you know, public presentation. Maybe people saw it. It was widely criticized in Israel as being offensive. But the idea was for that to then signal to get Israel to greenlight AIPAC in the U.S. to pressure the Congress and the Senate to escalate. So if you saw Poroshenko, because he speaks English, Zelensky really doesn't. Poroshenko speaks English, and he was on Fox News the day before yesterday. If you're in Europe with me here, it's the day before yesterday. And in that interview, he had a whole laundry list of things, and they basically want everything except soldiers, because they know that, like, you know, you can't get that commitment. But they want a no-fly zone that Ukraine can do. So they want the anti-air systems, the advanced ones, more of them, and they want more planes and fighters and radar technology, all kinds of things. They want all the things that they might not have, that they think would they be able to do a no-fly zone. Now, that's just on the face of it, not unreasonable. We're trying to look at all the angles here, because on the one hand, it has the potential to meet Ukraine's strategic objectives to limit the ability of the Russian forces, which really dominate the skies, especially in the center and east of the country and the parts of former Ukraine. But on the balance, it would not involve, in other words, Russia taking those out and attacking them wouldn't be a cause for war for any other countries. So what Poroshenko proposed, although I find him personally to be a disgusting figure, if you know about his biography as a child, he would bully kids to take their candy, and he loved candy very much as a child, chocolates, and he would bully them, take their candy, and then cry when they wanted it back and act like they were the ones trying to take it from him. And it seems like that's an honest thing from him. It's a type of, you know, psychopathy. And he would grow up and get into the chocolate business called Roshan Chocolates. So he's a billionaire in selling chocolate. So he's like Willy Wonka. He's like the evil Willy Wonka. It's kind of crazy. But his English is pretty good, and he spoke on Fox, so that's really the end of that. There's no BRI component to make Jerusalem the nexus of trade. That's a very bizarre, you know, I mean, just because I can't untangle that without just being like, that's bizarre, because it is bizarre. Israel's not aligned, has not aligned their economy in the direction of BRI, and they don't, Israel doesn't have good high tech. Israel is like, there was a Saturday Night Live skit, like back in the Belushi and Aykroyd days, and they were like aliens that arrived on Earth, and they like are talking to this Earth, you know, Earthling or whatever, and they begin to have a conversation. The Earthling is like trying to ask questions, like, wow, you guys have a spaceship, it's so amazing. And it turns out they don't know how to really maintain the spaceship. Actually, the advanced planet is the one next to them, and they like receive the spaceship. I think the whole skit was actually like a kind of a swipe at the state of Israel. It was hilarious. So they actually don't know how to maintain it or use it. And their solution for roads was to add more dirt to roads. Here, like, these aliens arrive in the spaceship, high tech. And then when they talk to the humans, humans like, well, you know, the aliens didn't understand why we paved our roads. Like, why don't you just use dirt and then add more dirt when it rains? So I know I have friends in chemistry and agrochemical concerns, and they get invited to Israel to show them how to do agriculture, and their own scientists are like very arrogant, but yet they don't know. And they invited them. It was really weird, dude. They invited all these scientists from Central Europe and the Balkans and Germany, and to go to Israel to be part of a seminar that was pitched like, we're going to teach you and show you Israel's latest state-of-the-art thing. But when they got there, it was like the Israelis being like, can you show us how to use this equipment that we were given, like, in, you know, different deals that we made with your countries? Can you show us how to use this stuff? So it was like, what? It was very bizarre. So it's not guaranteed or likely. BRI doesn't have an orientation towards Israel, just factually. So there's now Larry Fink. China has sovereign banking. So the fact that people like Larry Fink want to invest in China, that doesn't, they're trying to open up a way where they have a way a foot in, but that doesn't give them sovereign control or controlling influence over any of these concerns there. They're just talking it up. It really confuses people, as you can see by the question itself. So that's how I'll answer that. Okay. What do I think is driving Japan's, this is the next question. What do I think is driving Japan's hawkish position on sanctions against Russia? Well, Japan just doesn't really have a strong independent foreign policy, and it was getting a little bit stronger independent under Abe, and then he suddenly stepped down, and then you have this new guy. And if you know how to like tell a wanker by looking at him, you can just kind of take one look. You can compare the two men and be like, oh yeah, this guy's a wanker. That's about it. Next question is, good morning. Being from the US, we didn't realize there was a Nazi problem. I mean, we knew it never really went away, but just in the scale just blows my mind. Are there any other countries that have this large of a problem? Yeah, I mean, the same structures as Soros, USAID, National Endowment for Democracy, I think the government of Sweden, government of England, the government of Canada, all have. And they even have some UN structures, because these organizations get to pass off as humanitarian. But that happens on both sides of this conflict. UN is not really the problem, to be honest. The UN can be manipulated very easily, but it's open enough that it can be manipulated by different parties. It's kind of an open forum for manipulation. But with the Nazism in Europe, it's wherever you had the Soviet Union expand into after World War II, with the exception of Germany, is where you have like the strongest issue. Like wherever the Warsaw Pact really kind of grew in after World War II. So they weren't countries. They were countries often that might have been part of or connected to either at some point the Russian Empire or the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. But anyway, the countries that have the biggest Nazi problem that is being financed intentionally. I'm not talking about hooligans and bars and biker clubs and skinheads, although, you know, you might see some overlap. But the mainstreaming of this where, you know, what you might call like normal people are involved in this stuff because it's growing and being normalized and legitimized is like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. And of course, there's been attempts to do this in Belarus, but they're not having it. But definitely several attempted protest movements to make like to test the ground for color revolution in Belarus, even though CNN and all the different Atlanticist publications tried to make it seem like this was a like liberal human rights kind of stuff. The movements are very neo-Nazi apologist combined with this concept of Middle Europa, the Baltic to Black Sea initiative, this regard group, and this idea of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth revivalism. That's where this stuff is growing. And then besides that, unfortunately, you have Croatia just has built into its normalized system that the Croatian right, the Croatian normalized right wing is very Nazi apologetic and very, you know, sometimes openly Nazi. And you can see it in their banners if you know how to identify it. Like in Croatia, they have like that red and white checkerboard. And you look at the upper left of the checkerboard, and if the first square is red, that's like the normal, you know, neutral, harmless Croatia. But if the first square is white on the checkerboard, that's the Nazi era Croatian logo. So that's how you can quickly identify if you didn't look at other things. And then in Belarus, it's if they use the a kind of flag that looks like the Polish flag. That's because the Belarusian flag is like red and green, if I'm not mistaken, but it's mostly red with green. But the like Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth / neo-Nazi one is like a red and white where both colors are like about the equal size. And you'll see that throughout the region really gets used because that was the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth flag. That's where Poland inherited it from. That's all the places that it's really growing. And they're being financed intentionally by the same organizations that say that they're in favor of human rights, by the same NGOs and philanthropic organizations that financed PR campaigns for masking and mandatory vaccines are identical one-to-one ratio, like identical organizations, same people, same names that push these things, the neo-Nazism in those countries we just talked about. Next is, how is China and India going ahead with the World Economic Forum agenda and COVID World Health Organization drama at the same time keeping their positions with Russia? China and India are not really going ahead with it at all. So they're not. India actually was doing ivermectin, HCQ, a very similar protocol to El Salvador. Very commendable approach in my opinion, but I'm not a doctor. Okay. I'm just saying it's not my expertise at all. I just know like what all you guys would know. I don't claim any particular, I didn't go to school, but I have no practice in the field with this. You know, I'm not a virologist, epidemiologist, but just from, you know, just like you would understand from just kind of keeping an open mind and hearing things. But what I do know is that India is very, very upset with Bill Gates. They're very upset with World Health Organization vaccine mandate program, but World Health Organization is more than vaccines. There's been a huge focus on transforming the World Health Organization into the World Vaccine Organization, but there's pushback from countries, and India is one of them. India doesn't have quite the degree of development economically or sovereignty that China has, but they're getting there. And a lot of that has happened through Modi's government. And that's not because Modi is a great, he is like the hugging bear. He loves to hug everybody. He's like this lovable, squeezable teddy bear man. But inside the country, a lot of the policy people have reasons to not like it. Don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to be as neutral and objective as possible, given all my biases, right? But I just try to see things from different points of view. Obviously, I have a point of view, but I just try to see things from different points of view. And certainly, Modi began to open up India, to triangulate and have more different multilateral agreements, starting with Bush. And Bush really was involved with opening up India. And so India's on a decent path. They're just maybe like 25 years, maybe 15 years, 25 years. Yeah, more like 25 years behind China. And India has way more poverty than China. China has lifted China didn't do anything. The government didn't do anything. Government just allowed policies between, having regulations over here and deregulations over there, just, allowed people to pull themselves out of poverty. Probably, 400 to 700 million Chinese pulled themselves out of poverty in modern China. And India has certainly had progress, but they're not there. They're not just not there yet. They will be though. I love India. I think they're on the right path overall. And it's just these are not parts of the world that are going along with the World Economic Forum agenda. Don't let the people who run the World Economic Forum name drop. That's very different. That's like when producers in Hollywood say, yeah, we've got this guy lined up, we've got that guy lined up. It's all just to get other people to think that you're in control or that you've got things managed. They're over-projecting. The World Economic Forum is just the think tank of the IMF, and they are over-projecting their ability to do anything. So when they say things like, oh yes, invest in India, invest in China, those are their aims. They can. India is less sovereign than China, but China, just because you can invest in China, doesn't mean that you can control or own China. And that's a very big difference. And you can't invest in China to the extent that it determines their foreign policy. So the World Economic Forum agenda is depopulation, and China specifically moved away from depopulation. So people used to think, oh, in China, they're the country with the depopulation, with the one child only. Well, first of all, it was never really one child only. It was just one child actually got a free ride, free ticket for everything. The things that, you don't have a free ride for, they gave, but for your next children, then it was just pay your own way kind of thing, just like in the US. So it wasn't like they put you in jail for having two kids or something. It's just the first kid, everything was paid for by, through taxes, collective, tax pooling. I don't say by the government because governments don't produce wealth, but it was paid for by collective taxation. But your second and third child were paid for by your own income. You see what I'm saying? It's India is a better question than China. But India definitely had a problem with the vaccine mandates as a country. But see, these are not dictatorships. They have I'm saying India and Russia are not dictatorships. So they have governors and mayors, and they can be more trying to institute these mandates and stuff. And it can be more difficult for the central authority, because these are not dictatorships, to exert control over the states, provinces, regions, and cities that might do some kind of mandate or allow some amounts of the, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, shots to go in there. But it's not like a state policy. Does that make sense? Anyway, I hope I answered that. The next question, I'm reading here, just stay with me. China, Japan, that's too much of a historical question, John. Sorry, I wish I could jump on it. Will the Ukraine war end or spread into a larger conflict? Where it will actually leapfrog, if it spreads, it'll spread to where I am. The next hotspot is here. It's actually the first hotspot. When I first self-deployed to the region, I was under the impression, I mean, all my publicly sourced intel was that Serbia, former Yugoslavia, was going to have another series of things. And it did start to pop off at the same time as Ukraine, just a few years later in 2014. And that was, it's going to be here. And I talked about that last time. So if you know what I'm talking about, it just relates to what's going to happen in Bosnia. So if Bosnia tries to become a centralized state and get rid of the autonomous state of Serbia inside of Bosnia. And see, there's two Serbias people have to understand. There's a Serbia that's a UN country, that's an independent country, fully independent not in the legal formal sense, with the capital in Belgrade. And then there's another Serbia that's got a few million people, that's about half the size of Bosnia, and it's an autonomous republic inside of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And that their capital is Banja Luka, and their president is Dodik. And they've already done a dry run referendum for leaving Bosnia. So they want to leave Bosnia, and they want to join Serbia. And if they could do that, it would strengthen Serbia's position overall. And Russia sees Serbia, and has forever, like has seen since Serbia was under Ottoman control, Russia has seen Serbia as a little Russia, and really an extension of Russia in the same way that they see Belarus or Ukraine in many ways. And the union state stuff that Belarus has with Russia, there's been a movement this whole time that Serbia joins the union state with Belarus and Russia. I was invited to conduct public seminars and forums on the subject and in Minsk, Moscow, and Belgrade. And it was a very big effort. So my presentation on that, you know, gosh, this must have been 6 or 7 years ago. Maybe 6 years ago. And it's all based on how color revolutions are going to be planned to take place in Sarajevo. And I got a good feel. I was in Sarajevo and got to, you know, get my nose around and met with some people in my field and looked at the files. And I have good inside information that they are trying to get the Muslim Brotherhood within what looks like regular kind of Islamic center political parties to stage demonstrations in Sarajevo that are then going to lead towards an attempt to reform the constitution to then strip Bosnia of its federal status and to make it a centralized state, which would mess up, it would take away the autonomy of the Serbia inside of Bosnia. I hope that all makes sense. Let me know if that's clear. So that's where this conflict could spread. I mean, this is not just in my mind. I've been saying this for 10 years, and it became very amplified 8 years ago at the same time that Ukraine broke out. And I had colleagues on the ground in Maidan, and I had contact with people on both sides, including the information minister for the Pravi sector, for English language communications, which is huge because that's like their international effort. I think she went over to the some groups kind of like with a political party that superimposes on the Nazgardia, National Guard, which is integrated, fully integrated into the regular as part of the state in Ukraine. So yeah, there's a lot going on there. It would spread to the West Balkans before it's, you know, it's not going to spread to Hungary. I actually doubt it would spread to Poland. It could. I mean, without a lot of difficulty, it could. I just doubt that it would spread to Poland or the former Lithuanian Polish Commonwealth countries before it took off in the West Balkans. Does that make sense? So yeah. Where is Zelensky? Is the next question. I think he's in Poland. Do you believe Russia will break off diplomatic relations with the US? I don't believe so. No. This is like a very strange, bizarre, very modern, very, very contemporary tone only coming from Washington, D.C., that you break off diplomatic relations. This is a very new and bizarre thing. Wars can start, but you can't stop a war if you don't have diplomatic relations. It's a very bizarre stance. This is all coming from Washington. No one is trying. Listen, diplomats don't take umbrage. Do you understand me? Diplomats don't take offense. None of this is personal. Countries keep, have diplomatic missions, and they keep them open at great expense and with the ability to make sure that differences don't escalate, but also once things have escalated, even to the place of war. Okay, there's this idea that your emissaries are in the enemy country's capital and that they can be received by the sovereign even in a time of war. The idea of decapitating the emissaries and sending them back is a very, very bad thing. It happens in history, but it's a very, very bad thing. And Russia only has a policy of mirroring. So when the US decides that some of the staff of Russia's mission, its, you know, consular offices are somehow doing spying, which doesn't surprise me, but maybe they change the criteria of what's considered spying to be things that are not spying. Then Russia normally mirrors that by, you know, trying to find ways to eject equal numbers of people or equal significant stuff. Russia kicked out George Soros some time ago. So, and a lot of that stuff was like intermingled and intertwined with, they were operating some of these, they mix stuff up a lot. So it's hard to just think about war. Sorry for interrupting myself. Think about like in a war, right? Where you have like a humanitarian caravan, but you're trying to smuggle weapons in there. Okay. The NGOs are definitely hostile, but embassies are supposed to be neutral, right? And so, but what would happen is the US would operate NGO work through the embassies, you see? So by canceling the NGO work, it might look like they're coming after the embassy, but they weren't, okay? But on the balance, I don't think that we should expect Russia to initiate a further deterioration of diplomatic relations. Next question. Oh, hold on. My baby woke up. She woke up just now. Okay. Listening to Radio Church Service by Church of Christ, a large sect here, they are pushing the Russia is coming for Israel next prediction, telling congregation to stand with Israel. Is this a major problem for Russian support here in the U.S.? Look, this is an old Cold War canard and like the Gog and Magog stuff. And I think it's even misread. It doesn't even read scripture correctly. Trying to attach scripture to particular geographies can be very, very dicey stuff. And but it's a leftover of the Cold War. The reality is that Russia-Israel relations are very good. And in Israel, the language spoken probably in many ways more, even in many parts of the urban centers, not Hebrew, but Russian. So you have a lot of Ukrainian and Russian, like during the 90s or even the 80s, a lot of people like weren't even Jewish. They had like a Jewish grandmother, but it was a whole kind of brain drain policy, and it was called Operation Exodus, Save Soviet Jews. And they just, anyone who had like a Jewish grandmother or ostensibly a Jewish grandmother could relocate to Israel. And then from there, like even get US citizenship. And then once they got to, like the ones who went from Israel to the US, like even stopped pretending to be Jewish. Yeah, so, but it's a very, Russia doesn't have like a particular policy against Israel. Israel is not militarily or economically a significant country at all. There seems to be a very strong focus on Israel in the US from the left because of its, and in Europe because of its real bad treatment of Palestinians, but then also on the right, like on the far right, there's like this obsession that they think that this, you know, country is the same thing as what people see as a disproportionate, you know, whatever representation of people who just happen to have the same religion in who are actually American or English citizens. And some of them are, you know, Israel dual citizens, but it's just, that's not, the focus on that becomes bizarre, actually. If you, when you really deconstruct it, it becomes bizarre. Even anti-Semitic, even though you would ask people and they would say, oh, I'm not anti-Semitic, you know, to focus on that, to essentialize that aspect of the identity of what a person does. We should just say when, you know, bad people do bad things, it's bad, right? And there's lots of Jewish people doing nothing wrong. So to essentialize the Jewishness of criminals is almost to give everyone else like a pass, or to say, or then to even get even crazier and speculate that it's because they're secretly Jewish. Anyway, I'm done with that. But yeah, no, it's a longstanding tradition in the evangelical and Baptist churches in the US, and a lot of them have actually changed that, but there's still groups that promote this old view, this old Gog and Magog thing. Yeah, that's all. Brecht Jonkers, forgive me if I have that wrong, asked, there seems to be some confusion amongst analysts as to whether or not Russia is planning to eventually move further west in Kiev and Odessa, and whether it seeks to denazify the rest of Ukraine. Look, the denazification is complete and thorough. Denazification, you know, what post-Ukraine looks like, or a Ukrainian rump state looks like, or maybe even another independent state that's pro-Russian out of the people who still call themselves Ruthenian or Rusinian Carpathians. You know, the human and political geography of that region is very mixed, but people who call themselves Galicians are also known as Rusins, which were like, as the word Russian is like direct, you know, cognate, right? Or Ruthenians, which is also a cognate, in fact. But whether Ruthens or Rusins or Galicians have a state that's separate, it would have to also be a pro-Russian state. And denazification, you can't have a little tiny rump state where they are going to be NATO and then also go on this direction, this continued direction of breaking and or redefining US-Russia or Russia-NATO denuclearization agreements. Meaning, just like in concrete terms, like no fucking way is it, even if you have a tiny miniature neo-Nazi Ukraine, that you're going to have where it can have nuclear weapons. And the only way right now that that can be guaranteed is to completely denazify Ukraine. So it will go further than Kiev. Just that the importance of the strategy, these are gamed out. I'm not a fly on the wall, but I've been a fly on the wall in things in the past. And the level of planning and how the contingency things are laid out and the use of Bayesian statistics and semiotic flow charts, you know, like those ones that like, if this, then there's like two boxes that branch out. And then, you know, if this, then there's like three boxes that branch out. Like you can do that with like thousands and even millions of variables, and you need computers to do that. And actually how these things are planned out, even like the numbers of losses and conflict are all basically tabulation, like war games, and the outcomes within some standard mean of deviation are like known, like it to begin with. And that's why you've had people like General Flynn or Colonel McGregor say, yeah, like Ukraine's already lost this. It's like a mathematical, you know, conclusion. It's just war games. The outcomes are already known beforehand. So denazification is not about changing minds. It's about controlling any and all of the state institutions of Ukraine and the actual human beings and the institutions and the framework has to be completely taken down and rebuilt from the bottom up. Does that make sense? So, how is the German rearmament seen to the creators of the EU army? Well, that's part of it. So, Europe has different trends, and it's very complicated to summarize briefly, but just in 30 seconds. There is a trend that's strong in Europe to not be connected to the US. But for that trend to grow in Europe, the US has to see that as a possibility that Europe is under a unified command, that its agreements are stronger than NATO, but that in the final analysis could do US bidding. But then there's just many different possible outcomes. But if there were to put it this way, despite that many people have different ways they want to steer the growing EU army, which is distinct from NATO, even though many people are trying to build in structures and guarantee that it's basically even a more guaranteed version of NATO, if there were to be an independent Europe, independent of NATO and transatlanticism, it would also require the building of an EU army. Does that make sense? That's how to understand that. And Germany and France are the center of that anyway. So that's the same thing. Germany and France growing their military capacity is the same thing as the potential for an EU army. The thing that's distinct is that without transatlanticism, there's no economic or military impetus to really have an issue with the Russian Federation, and the economic integration would be just normalized, if that makes sense. Anyway. All right. East the web. A multipolar world is what is promoted by Agenda 2130. How can we ditch US NATO hegemony without walking into Agenda 20? Okay. That's a good question, but just keep in mind, this is the most important thing. No, originally it was not. Originally, you see, this is actually what you want to do is on this one, in the interest of time, is listen to the thing that's recorded from yesterday, a few days ago, where I explain in depth that there are two different agenda 2030s. There's UN Agenda 2030 And then there's World Economic Forum Agenda 2030. Okay. And the Agenda 2030 from the UN is non-binding, and the World Economic Forum's Agenda 2030 is only binding by countries that have to do what the IMF says. So it's about a degree of your sovereignty, and Russia is the most sovereign country. It's also the largest country in the world, by the way, by, like, you know, they have 9 time zones. You think so? The US has what, like 3-4 time zones? But in Russia has 9. It's just a huge country by square mileage, and they have lots of resources, and they're militarily very capable, and their structures, their oligarchy, doesn't control the state. Okay. They have influence in government and, of course, policy, but the state is different from government. And that can be hard for Americans, especially, to understand the difference between state and government. Europeans understand it because governments change all the time. In the US, the state and the government are like synonyms, which confuses our political discourse a lot, in fact. But no, it's not at all. A multipolar world is a concession, and the countries, see, for something to be palatable and interesting for the 190 something member states of the UN, it's actually like they don't want to live in a one world order, new world order, one world government. Okay, multipolarity is the you know, exclusion of that. It's 5 or 6 different poles. And it makes sense if you think about it. You would have maybe like 2 African poles, a Latin American pole, you know, a China and ASEAN, you know, ASEAN countries like Indonesia, Singapore is connected with the, you know, Jakarta, etc. Like that whole region is the Asian South Pacific, and those, and then you have Russia and maybe Europe together, or Europe and Russia separate, and then you have the Anglo-5 countries. Like, those are more connected by language, but the supply lines and security make it difficult to extend beyond an economic network. Australia, New Zealand, US, UK, Canada. So it's how this was marketed is not the same thing as that's their agenda. That's why you're here. Yeah, it can be very hard to unravel those things and to really understand them, because the World Economic Forum is really good at presenting things that are actually its own obstacles and things that actually work against what they want, okay, as their plan. Okay, for example, the World Economic Forum, like all those things within Agenda 2030, promote increased sovereignty of the countries. They promote increased longevity of people, even though we know that the World Economic Forum's way of interpreting Agenda 2030 is to allow them to do a depopulation campaign. So even though they might use the words multipolarity and they might use the word sovereignty of the, you know, member states of the UN, and the World Economic Forum is not a UN institution at all whatsoever, and even though they use the words like we want to increase literacy, even though we know they want to decrease population, you see, they use words like they want to decrease infant mortality, even though we know they want to force a greater vaccination schedule on infants. We're talking about 2 different agendas. The UN agenda is voluntary. Each sovereign country, each of the 190 odd countries in the UN, determines their own way of interpreting that and implementing that. And they don't even have to implement anything at all. It's completely, it doesn't come out of the Security Council. It's not a binding resolution from the Security Council on anyone. It doesn't even come out of the General Assembly. So you'll find I gave a longer version of this a few days ago in audios, and I think you'll find it elucidating. Okay. Thoughts about the talk going about a Polish-led peacekeeping force? That's a non-starter. That ain't going to happen. That's just Poland becoming a party to the conflict. It would be disastrous. That's why you're, if that's being offset by what you're seeing happen in Belarus. It could happen. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, wow. And the world could easily be crazier than it should be. But the default thing in my field is to be as conservative about potential outcomes as possible. Yet, you know, the Polish state has gone different directions. The status of Poland and its relationship with Russia has been a super heavy focus of Russian foreign policy. Like, Poland is super, super important to Russia, has been a very big focus of foreign policy. Yeah. And so Poland, that had been raised and dismissed by the Russian foreign ministry. That's the same thing as trying to have a no-fly zone or something. Did you see the problem? And that's actually involving Poland. So if I'm late on the morning's news because I'm doing this and I didn't see that, then I would talk about more details about, because usually the headlines, by the way, are very misleading. The headlines are very misleading. It's always, you got to dig. And then even the article, you got to dig behind that, because there's so much PR and marketing involved in coming up with these headlines. And the headline, the virtual reality of the headline, can satisfy the people who are trying to push for that, even though the thing doesn't actually materialize. Does that make sense? We saw that already, like with Turkey and how they're dealing with the Strait of Marmara or the Bosphorus, and the fake news kind of sounded like Turkey was siding with Ukraine, and then it turned out they weren't at all. So just, you know, I mean, yeah, they do the drone sales, but countries sell weapons. I mean, you know, Russia was selling weapons to Ukraine until recently. The whole thing, don't focus on those things so much. They're not important as much. As bizarre as that may sound to the layman, those aren't the critical things. Which is the next question. Well, we have Germany's role committing economic suicide. Yeah, is Germany committing economic suicide right now? Yes, they are. Yeah, Germany. The hopefully cooler heads will prevail, but their present policy is meant to plunge the entire eurozone into economic catastrophe. There's going to be food shortages, and there's going to be food prices are going to double, I think, by June, by that quarter, just basic food, when you go to the grocery store, it'll be like double, not from what it is now, but double from what it was last year. It was already like 30% higher. So it's already going in that way. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's going to happen within a couple months, like 3 months from now, it'll be very bad. Will Turkey, when it is forced to decide, join East or West Bloc? I'm not of the view that Turkey is forced to decide which bloc. I'm just not of that view. I think Turkey has, again, this is not about what people think about Erdogan or what color his underwear are or what things make him angry. Turkey is a rational state, which means that its decisions are actually not made by crazy people. They have a very strong diplomatic arm. They've been cleaning out the infiltration of the transatlantic commitments that were built into their own deep state. And so I do not, Turkish history is very interesting, but it weaves in and out. Like, the more you learn about other countries and how these things work with the deep state, the better you understand the situation in the US. And where my primary thesis about the US is, it is not just, you know, I'm not looking at what Benjamin Franklin or George Washington said or some speech that Kennedy gave. I'm not looking at that shit. I'm looking at the real, how the mechanics and the science of this works in all countries, intelligence organizations, sovereignty, when there's inter-elite conflicts that take place within countries, and they have a sort of a quiet, silent civil war and color revolutions, all kinds of things. So Turkey is definitely higher ranking sovereign state. They're not, you know, they have good enough relations. You know, what people are really afraid of, like the secret combination, like the secret deadly combination is Iran, Turkey, Afghanistan, all like having some an alliance like that. Like that's actually like the alliance that would really change a lot of people's thinking. And Turkey actively moves on that. There are, despite the differences over the Syrian conflict, before that conflict, the Persian pipeline was going to really connect Iran with Turkey in an energy consortium to market energy to Europe. But the sanctions kept Iran from doing that with Europe. That's what the whole framework of the JCPOA was all about. So no, I don't think that Turkey has to decide. I think that Turkey is in the position to even stake its own poll, because like they can triangulate. They're similar to India with a much smaller population, but they're similar to India. Like they can do deals with Europe, they can do deals with China, and only Europe would force Turkey to, you know, have a China-centered economic alliance, which I can see happening. So I guess as I develop your question, Faye P, it would be to the East Bloc if you're thinking in blocs. Costa, China not part of the World Economic Forum agenda? They invented lockdowns and social credit and started. Okay, so that's your opinion. That's not a real question. Thank you. How is Xi China not a dictatorship? These aren't questions. Please don't ask. Don't pretend you're asking a question to insert your own whatever understanding. You know what I mean? Because I'm not here. I'm not arguing here. I'm here to answer real questions. Okay. Not to explain why you are confused. You know what I mean? So, Suvada, if Russia is not embedded with World Economic Forum, then why aren't they? Okay, you're just this is just misinformed. That you're just been propagandized. I'm not. I can't. This actually, we have answered. So, read the post I shared from my colleague, Matt Arrett, Canadian Patriot Review, I think yesterday. Just look at that. Just look at that one. That one's going to help you the most. And any of the other things that we've been writing on this channel, because there's a lot of misinformation out there that's being promoted by the same people behind the agenda, and they want people to think that everyone's in on the agenda. Just think about, again, you're a salesman. This is all sales psychology as well. You're a salesman, okay? And you want everyone to buy your product, so you say that everyone's buying it, that's all. And you invent fake news about things, and you use the fact that people have met, or you also can manipulate the fact that people really don't know what these organizations even are, or to what extent they determine policy. So the World Economic Forum doesn't determine policy for any countries which are not themselves subordinate to the IMF, right? So that's why, so Belarus is actually the no bullshit Russia. So Russia has played this long game, etc. But Belarus, because Belarus is part of the union state with Russia, and Belarus policy, they exposed that the World Economic Forum, I guess it was the IMF, right? Because that's the real org involved. Whenever we talk about World Economic Forum, it's actually IMF is the economic engine of that. The IMF said to Belarus, we'll give you $900 million, just $1 billion, to do the lockdown, blah, blah, blah. Okay. China, like countries mirroring things like, or countries doing things like electronic passports, that's a technological thing. People who are over 35 on average, but under 65 are worried about that because you have more memory about not having those. But there used to be, you know, passports didn't used to exist in computers. They used to be like in handwritten, you know, registers, and people our age, you know, like in the 70s, when this information went into computers, also, you know, flipped out, right? And it's actually just, that's a fairly neutral thing. It's like really what governments do with it that is not neutral. So also the world is at war. Like people say, was World War III? World War III is asymmetric, unconventional, and fourth generational. So the doctrines of World War III, in for all intents and purposes, we are already in World War III, okay? And the thing is that, so countries that are sovereign and not part of the World Economic Forum and not part of the whatever the agenda of the cabal are like, and I explained this a week ago or two, how this works. And you have to understand, just think about it from the point of view, like put yourself into the world of antiquity in the transition into medieval Europe, right? So you had some states, but some cities that had walls and other cities that didn't have walls. So the cities that had walls could protect themselves, but then they could also, so then they could send their army out. They didn't need their army to protect the city as many because they had walls, and then they could conquer or attack cities that didn't have walls, okay? Now, the cities that didn't have walls then eventually decided to build walls. It doesn't mean there was a conspiracy between the two cities that have walls to build walls, even though it's an inconvenience and a privacy issue for the people who live in those cities, because when you go out from this city wall, you have to like identify yourself to the guards and whatnot. It doesn't mean that the two city states that are actually in conflict have a conspiracy to build walls. Those are technologically neutral things that develop and grow over time. And while one could have a more philosophical or nuanced criticism of technological processes in modernity on the whole, which are legitimate concerns, don't get me wrong, just in the plain speak of it, it does not signify or even suggest any alliance or part of the same agenda. It's just a technological changes that occur in societies. And as these are rolled out, you know, people younger than us will be growing up in it, and they'll be carving out, they'll be using technologies, and, you know, whiz kids will figure things out that will carve out and restore the balance of the human angle and the privacy and the freedom aspects of that. In the same way how your generation figured out things to get through the BS of society that was encroaching in its time, right? So for every new technology that has coercive, so long as it's maybe delayed in implementation or there's a lack of a central authority governing the whole world, as long as there's like a multi-vectored, multipolar reality and you have enough people who are understand the technology, then people who just like society's been basically slave society for thousands of years, and it's really just been people in general who figure out for themselves the ways to not be slaves, to, you know, to work for themselves or to start a small business. You know, most people are actually slaves already and have been forever. So that it's really the people who have the concern about what's going on now are people who are already have the tendency to want to be free. And I think that it's important to always oppose the things that are happening in where you can stop them. Unless you're in China, that's not your issue. But people who are on the ground in those places and aren't trying to sell you a particular political agenda, like from those places, because that often happens a lot. But like the real people on the ground know the situation better. And like in China, people figure out the loopholes to whatever they don't like about their system if they have that go-getter mentality, if they have that gumption, that chutzpah, that whatever, that even that joy de vivre, if you will. Like there's people who are just basically NPCs, and they would be slaves even in the least technological society. There are people who would be slaves even though the the cracker or the whatever, the slave driver takes a fucking 5 mile walk away, the slavery's in their mind. It has nothing to do with technology in that sense, but the technological changes that will liberate you, people will figure them out. So I wouldn't trip too many balls about that. Hello. Hi. Okay, I'm looking at this. John asked, will Serbia try to retake Kosovo? No, Serbia will not try to retake Kosovo, but it's actually Kosovo has within it another area in the north that is more Serbian, and that could break off. But the more conservative and problematic versions of that are the enclaves. But if the Serbian part more broadly, if those enclaves were connected and then, you know, geographically contiguous with free Serbia, then that would be the agreement. There's no real good incentive in practical terms for Serbia to want to have a Albanian minority in the south. They already have that issue now, because all the Kosovo right now, the Kosovo Albanians they're living the best possible life, and they're getting the best of both worlds, because right now Serbia recognizes them as Serbian citizens by Serbia's constitution, which means that they can get a Serbian passport. They don't already have one, and they can live anywhere in Serbia, which is actually fueling an Albanian pronatal policy to have more children than Albania can manage, so that Albanians move to to Macedonia, North Macedonia and Montenegro, that Albanians move into Kosovo, which pushes Kosovo Albanians into Sanjak and other regions of Serbia, where the Albanian population is growing and going to create a further demographic imbalance. You know, backing up more, it's the Russian model is a very good model, a multinational model. Serbia, because of the 90s, got into overly narrowly identifying itself by the identity of the primary state forming people. But Yugoslavia was a system, and the Kosovo autonomous region in Serbia is inherited from when all of Yugoslavia was a system, and it became less tenable by the natural gravitational forces of human geography once the definition of Yugoslavian shrank and shrank until it became Serbian. It becomes less tenable to hold on to Kosovo with Serbia having a narrower definition of what it means to be Serbian. So either Serbia has to broaden its definition again, or has to do something else with Kosovo. But what many have proposed as foreign ministers and different prime ministers and countries, all the way up from the Baltic, all the way down through Central Europe, Austria, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, all of them are pretty okay with, unless, you know, the shit hits the fan, which it could, that the Serbia Republic inside of Bosnia joins independent Serbia, and then Kosovo, the Serbian parts of Kosovo then, or maybe all of Kosovo, Serbia recognizes as independent. So there's just, but that question of Kosovo is so sensitive that no Serbian leader could stay in power after changing the constitution of Serbia. Doing so would be even a foreign plot, you know, to destabilize the present Serbian state, not just the government. So I don't think Serbia will retake Kosovo, nor do I think they will recognize its independence. I think they want to status quo that as long as possible, and until the overall situation of Russia is better defined and the situation that's popping up in Bosnia doesn't go out of hand. Could you expand on the EU creation military force? Well, just that for independent Europe would have its own military force. So the fact that NATO is kind of trying to build in guarantees into it is just part of how plans work. Plans, the contrary plan always works through the dominant plan. It's always the plan works through the plan. That's all. Next question. And if Vučić and Brnabić are such known supporters and implementers of EU, NATO, US, how much reason do the West need to start something in Serbia? Well, that's your, you see, no offense, okay? But the reason you think that is because of a very deep-seated psychological operation going on inside of Serbia to make Vučić appear much more close to NATO in the EU than the actual geopolitical supra-personality state of Serbia is. So if Vučić was loved by Serbian nationalists, then that would be evidence that Vučić is not serious about EU integration. But for Serbia to join, Serbia will never join NATO. And it's, even though Vučić has said exactly that thing many times, that's not the reason why. Because you don't, no one should believe what politicians say. The security agencies and the role of Russia and its relationship to CSTO is such that that Serbia will never have more than a partnership for peace. NATO just basically means that because Serbia has the highways of the West Balkans. Because you can't drive through Montenegro, anyone who knows that, right? That takes like 12 hours to drive 300 kilometers, like 200 miles or 180 miles takes 12 hours, okay? You can't drive through Montenegro. And driving through Romania is a whole different, that goes through like, that's like the Bucharest-Sofia, you know, Bulgaria-Romania line. That's a different geography. You don't want, if you want to go through the West Balkans from NATO Greece into NATO north of, you know, Hungary or north, that's, you have to go through Serbia. So Partnership for Peace just means that NATO drives through Serbia. That's all, okay? There's no Serbia is not militarily activated by Article 5, et cetera, et cetera. It's not a NATO member, and it can't be. And EU, there are like 20-something chapters for EU membership, and Serbia hasn't even opened them. I think if they reach tentative agreement on one chapter, that would surprise me. Maybe it's moved forward. But if you moved into Europe at a very fast pace, it would take 10 years at about 6 months per chapter to reach a tentative agreement. And so therefore, if they've reached maybe tentative agreement on one of those, honey, has Serbia reached any tentative agreements on EU, any of the chapters to join the EU? Yeah, we don't think any of them. So, and there's 20 of them. So it's you know, their application for membership was accepted or whatever it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and nothing has moved forward since then. So like, even though it's a popular trope and belief, and I think a positive one, because it creates the illusion that's important at this time, about Vučić and Serbia. I'm not endorsing any, you know, Vučić's domestic policies and the relationship with the Serbian oligarchy and everything like that. We're just talking the geopolitical position of Serbia is not even up to Vučić, and that's not a bad thing. The Russian influence in Serbia is very big, and the German influence in Serbia is also big, and that's an influence that's independent from the U.S. influence. So. Yeah, it's a very different question. And I know I don't answer these things the way that people might want me to answer them, but that's my actual analysis, and it hasn't changed unless the real facts have changed. And it's not an emotionally driven or politically driven analysis. I know very well where, you know, the magazines and the newspapers that produce that, and the materials suggesting that the Serbian government is closer to EU or NATO. And it's just not. If you actually read or looked at, you know, DW, German and or BBC stuff on Vučić, they always accuse him of only pretending to want to go into the EU. And that's because they're, you know, about 90% right about that. Let's see. Good. I'll end with this. I'll answer two more. And just thanks for being with us, guys. This is about social credit system in China. Do I have info about it? How it works? Yeah. So look, the thing is this, guys. If you're a German or English or American listening right now, you guys already have social credit like for so long, and it's actually far more extensive than China's. And I have big criticisms of Chinese bureaucracy and any big system. Okay, that's my own personal view. So I'm not like a China guy or anything like that. I just try to understand things, right? And the fact of the matter is that China only recently, okay, so let's compare the US and China just in terms of these things understanding, okay? The United States started its first industrial revolution at the close of the 18th century with its independence from England and its transformation away from being a colony that exported raw materials to England for production and then that were sold back to the US. That's what the American Revolution was about. So the first industrial revolution began in America around 1790s, okay? And the second industrial revolution continued through was very slow going through the 19th century. And the third industrial revolution started with computers and maybe the first home PCs. You could say the 60s or 70s was the beginning of the information revolution, which is the third industrial revolution. Okay. China went through all three of those revolutions, okay, but unevenly, very unevenly, went through those all within a period of like 40 years. So think about that. So what America went through over 200 years, right? China went through in 40 years. But that meant that it was very disproportionate between the urban centers and the cities and the industrialized areas and the peasant economies and where the peasants and the rural, you know, people and villages lived, okay? And so if I say, what's your FICO score? You don't lose your fucking mind and be like, oh my God, social credit, but that's exactly what it is. Or when you think about your LinkedIn account or how employers look at your FICO score and look at your Facebook and your LinkedIn and they determine if you should be canceled or not, that's been in place for 20 years. So I think employers looking at FICO scores, Equifax, you know, is it 500, 600, 700, right? Like when you go to buy a house or lease a car, buy a car, employers ask for that. They've been doing that since what, the 90s? 2000? So that's social credit for the West. And you've already had credit cards and all that. So China, in the rural parts, remember China lifted, you know, whatever, 500 million people out of poverty over a 40-year period. But that doesn't mean that they were modernized in the sense of like Paris, Berlin, New York, Los Angeles, Tokyo. You see what I mean? So social credit, so the thing is that, but you don't necessarily have a mechanism. If you don't have industrialization, okay, or if you don't have a modern or postmodern economy, then you don't really have the same basis for a financially driven credit system, do you? Right? But because all of these like developing world countries and China has the sovereignty to do it, develop in a combined and uneven way. Right, so it's combining technologies that, like, because in China they have all the same computer systems that you have in the West, in the way of like documenting when people are born and do they have a criminal record. So social credit, because in China, the state is more powerful than the companies. So social credit actually began being directed at companies. So like in America, you have the Better Business Bureau, or maybe you have like Geraldo Rivera or David Horowitz pointing out, or Ralph Nader pointing out like when businesses are bad or something. But that's it. We actually don't have shit with that, right? But in China, because the state would check businesses for compliance and complaints. So that social credit actually began as enforcement, as a Better Business Bureau that had fangs. And then secondly, social credit was like, how do you look at someone who lives in a rural place who doesn't necessarily have internet themselves and certainly doesn't have, you know, a LinkedIn account or a FICA credit score? How do you evaluate them so that if they move from one part, like where people don't know them, and now they're have the anonymity of an individual person moving from one city to another city or from the village into a city, how do you know, how do you get, because China has so many different regions and provinces, and you need to centralize things like your criminal history or your things like that. So social, I'm not trying to make it sound like hunky dory, you know, I would like to live, you know, 20,000 BC, right? But talking about technology and reality, that's how I understand Chinese social credit. Now it can go like in a very bad direction. What is it, baby? It can go in a very bad direction, and it maybe already is, but in its origins and where the word comes from, it's very, you can understand it like, okay. Just closing on color revolution in Bosnia then, and that'll be the end. The missile, so a missile hit Zagreb on the 9th or 10th or 11th, and it was an attempted false flag, in my opinion. And it was called a drone, but it was actually like a missile that can be steered and had like wings, but it's a detonatable object. It's like a kamikaze drone. So it's actually like a missile that kind of looks like a very big plane. And it hit in Zagreb. I don't think it detonated actually, but it just, the size of it and the weight of it caused some damage and stuff. And I think that was an attempted false flag, because it was a type of missile that they're going to say is Russian because it was Soviet made, but Ukraine has all the Soviet made stuff. So it goes back to that whole thing with the, you know, the flight that went down, you know, 7 years ago, the Malaysia Airlines flight. And, you know, was it Ukraine? Was it Russia? Because they have similar weapons, you know. But the thing is that Russia no longer uses that particular missile. Calling it a drone made it sound way more high tech and like normal. So if they say, oh, like if you read headlines that came out right away, they said a Russian made drone, and then you make you think that this was made like 3 years ago and that Russia made it, but actually it was Ukrainian. And that was very similar to something that just happened like 10 days before that, where Ukrainian S-300 shot down a Romanian plane. And obviously that they wanted to make it look like Russians shot down Romanian plane to draw, you know, because Romania is a NATO member, and to draw Romania into the conflict, because that's, you have like, you have Moldova, and then you have the little Transnistria that feeds into, you know, Moldova, Transnistria kind of feed into Odessa, which is Ukraine. So yeah, that's my read on that. It was obviously a failed. I think that the Croatian government handled that very responsibly. Any other government that was eager to get into a war with Russia would have declared at the beginning of investigation that they believed it was Russian. So yeah, that's going to conclude our briefing and Q&A session for today. I want to thank you all. I did record this one. Yes, that's my surprise for you. So if you joined in now, or you'll be able to hear this from the beginning, unless it renders badly. So let's hope it works out. All right, take care. Bye-bye. This has been Joaquin Flores.